Craig Potten is one of New Zealand's foremost landscape photographers. You can see some of his latest work on our web page. He's an activist, an environmentalist, a publisher, an explorer, Nelson-based, and seems to have travelled practically everywhere in the world, including Mongolia, where I last saw you, as was I, trying desperately to get out of Ulaanbaatar Airport. Hello, how are you?
Very good, thanks, Kim. Good to be here.
It took me longer than you to get out of Ulaanbaatar Airport.
Yes, I think that's the fact of travelling in the East quite often, is that they have a different sense of time and a different sense of telling you when they're ready or not ready to go. And
it wasn't that at all. It was the story was. Are you saying that the story we were told that the communists built the airstrip the wrong way, so that every time there was a bit of a wind, such as in Wellington would be a relatively normal wind, they had to cancel all flights because it was a crosswind?
Yeah, but it was the fact that they didn't tell us that we weren't going to fly that night.
Oh, no.
Until we'd been there 5 hours.
In that very small room with nobody who could speak English.
Precisely.
Well, I thought we all dealt with
it. That didn't worry them. It just worried us.
I thought we all dealt with it astonishingly well. Let us talk about the photos that we have up on our webpage, actually. One of them is a photo of the same place that's been taken at different times, correct?
Yes.
What is this?
We're looking at the sand dune one in particular, are we?
No.
No.
Did you do two photos of the sand dune?
I did one of the sand dune, and I'm struggling now to remember what the other shot was.
The other one was
of
the double, the forest interior, the double take.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Double Take is a book that I've been thinking about for a long time, but this year finally got action on, and that is that ever since I started taking photographs, I'd often take an image very, very close to the other image that I'd preceded it, and I'd just move the camera very slightly on a tripod. It was quite specific. It was very much that I was making a perfect composition, getting everything in the right place. That's all fine, except when I get to the light box, I have to decide between the two, which is the one that I'll present both to myself and to the world as you know, this is the archetypal image
I want. So this is you avoiding how to make that decision?
Well, Kim, that's too hard. No, it's more
You know me, Craig.
Yes.
Hey?
To be forewarned is to be forearmed, but nevertheless, you can still knock me over. But no, I've decided, perhaps ingeniously or disingenuously, to do a book called Double Take, where I'll put both the photographs side by side and the viewer will be forced to look at both of them. They can make their own response to it, but I will feel happy that I have been able to not resolve the difference between two images.
Wow.
That often when I look at a place, and even when I look at a people or a look at anything, I might have two ways of seeing it. They might be very, very close to each other, but they're subtly different. So I've sort of written an essay at the beginning that sort of explores around that idea.
So it's a bit like writing a novel but leaving the ending up to the reader.
No,
can I put that to you, Mr. Potten?
No, you definitely can't, because that's too much that the other is involved. When you create a work of art, it's finally you that's doing it, and whether the rest of the world responds or not really isn't the end of the world, or it's not the prime purpose of doing it. The purpose is to get something out of your system, out in an objective way, out into the world. And when you can't decide between the two, and when you think they inform each other, then you're allowed to say that they're a double take and make a book around it. If you've lived as long and taken as many photographs as I have, you're allowed to give yourself that chance to do it.
Do you think that you would have travelled so much if you hadn't been a photographer?
Hey, that's a good question. I probably would have. My mum and dad put a huge sort of desire to see the world into me from a very early age.
You had the wherewithal to do it, right? Your father was a successful businessman.
He was a successful business by that stage of his life. I mean, he started very poor. He built himself up into a situation where he could take his family on holidays. And the thing I appreciated about my father and my mother was that when school finished, the day it finished at 12 o'clock on Friday, they took the whole time off through the school holidays to spend with us. And not many parents do that. And so they would take us to Fiji in winter because it's cold, or they'd take us down to Queenstown because if it's cold you go skiing, or Mount Ruapehu. But they put the time in with us when we were young. That was absolutely wonderful because they took us to marvellous places both within New Zealand. Every winter, Mum would say, we've got to go south to see the snow. That was her phrase, and we'd jump in the Jag or whatever, and we'd drive down the west coast. We'd go to Hokitika and have a sandwich and an old cup of bad tea, and then we'd drive on till we got to Queenstown. And those good old days, those halcyon days, and we'd look at the snow on the mountains, have a ski or not, and come home again. So there were sort of imperatives of enjoying the land.
Do you think that they were conservationists?
I think in their own way. Dad has a checkered history like we all do, so he was involved in tuna fishing with the bad boys in fishing, but he also acknowledged that nature was extremely beautiful. We had batches in places like D'Urville Island and big boats that we sailed around the ocean, and he knew that we
batches
were...
Batches and boats. Do you have a Beamer?
What's a Beamer?
A BMW. You know, no. That's the Kiwi dream, the batch, the boat and the Beamer.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Come
yeah,
on.
Three Bs. Okay, no, we had Jaguars for Mum.
Of course.
Yeah, because they were stylish, you know, so the E-Type was sort of the model that you kind of had to aspire to. But that's beside the point. The point was that we got out to nature.
I love it when you stick to your point.
Well, I like to come back to where
but
we
that's
might
beside
go.
Beside the point. Yes, and there you were.
And there we were looking at these extraordinary happenings in nature. And Dad realised, with a lot of melancholy, and he was a melancholic man, like a lot of fathers perhaps seem to their children. You know, Kierkegaard had the same problem with his dad, I might add, that they sort of saw
that's
that...
That's beside the point.
Well, no, they saw the world collapsing. They didn't think it was as good as when they were back there. And the irony is that they were dead right. You know, we are doing a great disservice to nature. We know this now. It's so very, very, very obvious. And they were the post-war generation that were doing the destruction. So, you know, I grew up both realising how beautiful it was out there and being out there in the world, but also feeling, even from a father who was doing the damage, he helped open the chip mill in Nelson, for instance, that, you know, we were sort of in an end game. We were going to run out of resources. He knew that. I knew that. It was a sad situation.
Were you on the same page or did you argue with each other
argued,
about it?
We argued, but there was a sort of a mutual respect at a distance. So when he was talking to other people, he would say, I'm very proud of my son. He's serving the West Coast Forest and he's just climbed Mount Cook. But when he's with me, he said, that's a damn foolish thing to do. Why don't you go and get a real job? Yeah. So
what about your mum?
Oh, she was, well, people would not like to know that I think my mum was an angel necessarily, but she was a very wonderful person, very open, and she was just a very loving person, a very giving person, and she adored her two sons. So I've, as an artist, have grown up in that sort of context of the loving mother that could do no wrong. Obviously, she did have faults, and I do know what they were, but I won't say them on national radio.
No. In fact, the first track you've chosen, I just ran this past you to see whether this was a good track to start off with, because it was Puccini O Mio Bambino Caro, which was played at your mother's funeral because it was her favourite piece. So this is all right to play?
It's perfectly all right to play.
It's not going to set you off weeping.
If it does,
well, if it,
it
does,
wouldn't
that's
matter.
Fine.
We're in a dark room and
no,
they can't see us.
Exactly,
this is not television. But
I've long relied on this.
But it was also something that she would play when we came home from school and the light was shining across the bay in the evening, and we had this wonderful house on the hill that, with this music from Kiri Te Kanawa blasting through the living room while we sat there and had our milkshake after school. You know, Mum brought a lot of joy into our lives, and music brought a lot of joy.
Piace bella.
Kiri Takanawa singing O Mio Bambino Caro, which oddly enough means Oh My Dear Papa, from an opera that I didn't know and Craig didn't know or had forgotten. It's hard to tell your
probably
age, isn't
know,
it, dear?
To be honest.
Gianni Schicchi, a one-act opera. Yes, Kiri Takanawa, goodness. So your mother passed...
it would be a couple of decades ago now.
Yeah.
And, it was very sad. It was a cancer, a melanoma. So I certainly get my mole checks recently, or regularly, should say.
Do you?
Yeah. Because they never found the primary of it. So it became a brain tumour. But she was very positive right to the absolute end and gave us a great message to, you know, go on enjoying life. And just had a huge impact on me, that was all, as you do when you lose someone you absolutely love. But she saw Michael when he was young, our son, so that was wonderful. But I think now that I've got a young daughter, I've remarried after my wife died, it's very, very hard for me to accept that Rhoda never saw my daughter, Bella Rhoda Potten, because I think they would have just got on like a house on fire.
Are you a Buddhist?
I'm kind of a Buddhist. I mix, as contemporary people do, from a bit of a selection, a potpourri of both Hindu, Buddhist, and this sounds almost very pretentious to rush right across all these great religious systems, but Jewish theology and even a touch of Christianity.
Your mother had Jewish ancestry, didn't she?
My mother, to my knowledge, didn't, no. But
Where did I read that?
I don't know. Perhaps it's a crossing with the fact that my wife, Beverly, my first wife, was Jewish.
Oh, I knew that.
Therefore, Michael, my son, is.
That's strange.
Yep.
Misreporting bites again.
Mm.
But you have pick and mix Jewish and Buddhist and Hindu. And
I mean,
you could create your own religion. Essentially, you could become a cult leader.
It's not often I'm lost for words.
I
would really love.
I saw it going. You thought I could.
I thought the opposite.
I really could do that.
I thought the opposite. I thought you'd become slightly unhinged in suggesting that.
No, I do not mean to mock. What I meant to ask was, does your interest in spirituality, Buddhism, whatnot, does it help that feeling of loss?
I think it helps it immensely, and I think it does and always has, in the sense that when I was, right from a very early age, thinking, well, why do I have, you know, very strong feelings of joy around nature and around certain people that I really love, and, you know, what's the nature of that joy? Is it something that is just, you know, within me, or is actually the world out there rather an ordered, beautiful place despite everything that goes wrong in it? And, you know, is there meaning in all? Those sorts of very adolescent, early questions. And they came very, very early with me. So, you know, by the time I was 10, 12 years old.
Really?
Yeah, so...
You were quite a...
I sort of spent a weird sort of youth...
Deep child.
Yeah, weird sort of youth of getting up an hour before everyone else got up and make myself a cup of tea and read quite heavy books from a very early age. And when I was an adolescent, I didn't actually like going out to parties because people just drank and made fun and made noises and things. So I'd often sit at home and read and think. And, yeah, I've got a bit of a burden of overthinking things, perhaps.
Anyway,
yeah.
It makes the loss of people. I mean, you've lost some very dear people to you, your mother and your wife, Andy Dennis.
Yeah. Yes. And I think sometimes you just have to sit with your sadness. You can't obviously pretend it's gone away. You can't find a higher purpose in it. You can't solve it by distracting yourself with happiness of, you know, around food or drugs or doing lots of things. That doesn't work for me. What works best for me is just I sit on the bed in the afternoon at home and just look out at the ocean and the sunset, and my daughter comes in and we hug each other, and you're still in pain, but you are just working through that pain and the speed it takes to work it through. And I guess in some ways I've been lucky as an artist to be able to create often work out of pain. So what we're doing to nature is horrifying, Kim. It really is. It's existentially terrifying what we are doing to nature right now in the oceans, the waterways, as Mike Joy will tell you, etc. If you can create
art... You're doing
art,
a television programme with Mike Joy, aren't you?
I'm not. My son is doing some photography video around work, which he is doing a couple of programmes, in fact, and I'm not directly involved in them.
Oh, okay.
Dealing with that amount of pain, if you can make it into images that are somehow objective and useful to other people to find hope, then I think that's a role of an artist that, without being too didactic, is a very cool and good thing to do.
So what are you saying, that your photographic work...
Well, let me give you an absolute example, which is when Beverly was dying, she gave permission for me to photograph her through that dying process. And Helen Innes, one of the great curators in Australia of photography, picked that up, and I don't actually know where she got it from, that I'd done those images. And we showed it at the National Museum in Canberra, the art gallery, the major art gallery there, after Beverly had died. And people have taken a lot of, in response back to me, they've taken a lot from the fact that there's a sense of dignity around everything that happens in life, even if it's not something that is, absolutely fun and laughter. And I think the same thing with nature, that if I can show images like I do in Double Take of beautiful forests that you hopefully are addressed by in this book or in the images on the wall, then you are seeing, yes, humans do some absolutely dreadful things, and you can be as cynical and as sarcastic and wipe it away as easy as you want to by saying we're going to hell in a handcart and we can't do anything. I don't want to do that. I want to actually say, there is such beauty in the world, and we will live and by that beauty, and the beauty will save us.
You're never worried that people will look at your beautiful, beautiful photographs and think, oh, all's well with the world. We've got heaps of nature left.
I don't think anymore they'll do that. I mean, I think the main thing these days is just the degree to which we push it away and just internalise and become, you know, self-seeking, happy individuals. That's the real danger, not actually acknowledging what's happening outside of ourselves, out there, in inverted commas, the other world or the real world or whatever language you want to use, but essentially, nature. So, no, I'm not worried about beauty being overplayed in those sorts of respects. I'm worried about people through, and your previous speaker, social media and others creating their own echo chambers rather than... a good piece of art should break down an echo chamber.
Your next track is Bure. I don't know what Bure means.
Neither do I.
But this was a famous...
Can I tell a story?
Yeah.
The story is interesting because I didn't know it was famous. I went in 1973 to an Ian Anderson Jethro Tull concert in Christchurch at the Town Hall, and he played, like the madman that he was, on his flute, this beautiful song, this just... you're just so beautiful, and no words at all. It was just a tune, and I have had that tune playing in my head, and I mean this, and people sort of laugh in a way, but almost every day of my life I wake up with do-do-do-do-do-do-do, what we're going to hear.
Yeah.
I had no idea where it came from. I thought Ian Anderson must have tapped into the, you know, gestalt of Western music to be able to pull this tune out. 25 years or so after I've had this music playing through my head when I'm about 50 years old or so, and I find it from Bach, from Johann Sebastian Bach. I had no idea for 30 years. So obviously he's the guy, you know, and I've listened to Bach all my life, but I just hadn't heard that piece come up. He taps into something that's archetypal in the musical response that we have, particularly in Western culture, and I'm very, very grateful for that song. It's taken me forward a lot, or that piece of music, I should say.
And Bure, I found, is a lively French dance, like a gavotte.
Brilliant, because if we've got time, we're going to have another dance later on of a klezmer nature.
Okay, then.
Thank you.
Jethro Tull with the Bach tune Bouret. I'm talking to Craig Potten. When did you first become involved in conservation? Very first.
Yeah, very first was when I was at Nelson College. So I was probably around 16 years old, and I heard of a petition to stop raising the level of Lake Manapouri for an aluminium smelter down in Invercargill. And I can't remember exactly how I made the contact, but very quickly I was collecting signatures to stop that raising of the lake level. And from then on, I went to university at the very first term that I got to Canterbury University. We formed with Guy Sam and Gwenny Davis from Wellington and Philip Alpers and someone else from Auckland and Jerry McSweeney and myself in Christchurch, the Native Forest, what that time was the Beach Forest Action Committee, which morphed into the Native Forest.
But how did you latch onto that? Were there people at school who were...
With the Manapouri, it was that I heard. Either the news of some form got to me, you know, radio, television, obviously.
You were very...
Proactive might be the word.
Yes.
If I care about something, I go there, find it and do it, sort of feeling. So, I found people, and of course it was Alan Mark, and it was many of the people that still involved in conservation, Les Cleveland, that raised the flag on Manapouri and that fought for Manapouri, and they were in Otago, and I contacted them, and they sent me petition forms.
And then, of course, you got involved in the West Coast with the Beach Forest Action Committee. You became the Native Forest Action
Maria
Council in the 1980s. And you must go through there and photograph forests that wouldn't have been there had you guys not been involved in that.
Absolutely. If I can feel proud of one thing I've done in my life, it is saving native forests in New Zealand, particularly on the west coast of the South Island. I think that's my great legacy, if I've got a legacy. Take the word great away. And the Central North Island rainforests of Pariora and Uruwera, Whirinaki. Because, yes, exactly that, Kim. They would have been logged had we not saved them. And there were probably only about 15 or less people that were very committed to the extent that they gave up everything else they were mainly doing. I obviously kept surfing and a few things that it's impossible to give up. But otherwise, luckily Guy and Gwenny and Annie Wheeler and other people didn't surf, so they worked all the weekend as well. They gave up their lives, and I did too, so that we just worked our guts out for about a decade, and then we got a little bit mature and didn't work quite so hard, but we still worked very, very hard.
I mean, opposition to logging in those days was tantamount to treason.
Oh, it was treason. Yeah, absolutely. The first letter I wrote when I was 16 years old to Nelson Evening Mail, the Conservative Forest in Nelson, because that was in the bad old days of the Forest Service and Lands and Survey, Peter Mapleston accused me not of treason but of defamatory, and he would take me to court, etc. So here was a 16-year-old being threatened just by writing a letter to the newspaper, you know, the open forum of our media, that they were threatened with defamation of character, which of course it wasn't, and he didn't, but it was considered treason to go against the Kicks in those days.
Goodness, what on earth did you say in that letter?
I said it was wrong to cut down the forest. We didn't need it. We were just making chips to go to be made into toilet paper
what?
In Japan.
You can't say things like that.
That's back
outrageous.
To us. Precisely. But... over the years, we've finally got the book out. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but we published last year the book Fight for the Forest.
Yeah.
And it has obviously a wonderful sense of nostalgia for those involved in the battles. But I hope, more importantly, the reason Robbie Burton and I published it was that it would give a message that, yes, you can make changes, and those changes can be quite profound. It doesn't take a lot of people to make those changes. It takes a lot of commitment and passion to make them in good science. And I've written a 6-page introduction to Paul Bensman's text in which I've tried effectively to tell people in a gentle way but quite directly 6 points that you need to do if you want to be successful in changing, you know, the political situation to the outcome that you want.
What's the first point?
Well, the points are, and I've tried to remember all 6 of them, but I don't have them in front
of me.
Well,
I was making it easy for you.
Yeah. That's how you're meant to remember things. My brain doesn't quite work like that.
I wasn't going to get through the whole 6.
No, good science.
I was just going to say, good, just give me a point.
What's the most important?
Anything that springs to mind.
Yeah, well, science.
Whatever.
Good arguments, rational arguments are absolutely important, balanced against, you know, just deep-seated passion and love and concern. But the main thing is to get it through, I've got 3 already, get it through legislation. unless you get legislative change, unless you get the government to make a decision and change the law, then all this fluffing around and media and everything else is a waste of time. So you do have to get on the inside. And several others got involved in local politics, and of course Rod Donald and others in national politics. But we lobbied everyone inside the National Party. It didn't matter who they were. If they were part of the decision-making process, get inside their heads, get inside the legislative framework, and in other words, work from the inside, no matter how radical your perspective is. And ours was radical and still is on radical issues like, you know, animal rights, etc. But unless you get that change there, it's all just a lot of noise, a lot of moaning, and nothing happening.
You stood for the Greens on the list.
Yep.
Number 22, I think, which was remarkably optimistic.
If one is honest and one should be honest, then I did place myself further down the list than Rod wanted me to be. But and I did make a promise to him that when my son Mike went to university, I would stand and allowed to be further up the list. Sadly, Rod died, so perhaps fortuitously I didn't have to honour that honour.
So you actually never really wanted to get in?
There'd be the truth that we shouldn't say on national radio, Kim.
You would never do it again, national politics?
Well, recently some people have sort of pointed at me because I'm no longer on the executive of Forest and Bird and not as directly involved, not on the Conservation Authority and other things that I were doing. Hey, Craig, why don't you stand nationally? I mean, it's not no, but I have a 9-year-old daughter. My rotator cuff in terms of paddling for surfing, my enjoyment of life in terms of taking photography and getting certain things through. Perhaps at the ripe old age that I am, I might not have to stand, but rather encourage younger people to have a go.
What are you saying? A rotator cuff will stop you standing for national politics?
Well, no, it means that there's a point at which if it collapses and I can't surf, yes, I would stand for national politics.
Ah, so if your rotator cuff gets worse,
yeah, this is,
and you can't go surfing anymore,
can't paddle a surfboard,
you might just devote yourself to the country. All right. Well, bear that in mind. How's publishing these days?
Publishing is hard. People are not buying books like they used to, but people are still buying
books. Well, big, glossy, expensive books.
I don't think
coffee table books.
They're not even buying the non-fiction work that we're doing as well. You know, it's like Ghost of Gondana or whatever will sell more than our new version of it, possibly. I mean, I don't want to jinx anything, but numbers of books selling in New Zealand by New Zealand publishers has declined rapidly. I don't want to sound doom and gloom. We've downsized our company, so that was sad. Some wonderful workers no longer have a job with us. We've put our distribution with another company, but we're intent, we being Robbie Burton and myself and our small unit now, to continue to publish socially relevant books around political issues. Of course, you know, we published Nikki Hager, but also books that inform us more of the land that we're in. So we are working on a new book with George Gibbs, who wrote Gondana Land, about Hudson, who did this marvellous book on a long time ago and illustrations on our butterflies. So we're intent to keep publishing going, and so far it's been successful, but it's at a smaller scale than it was.
Mm. Mm. You started up the publishing company because you wanted your books printed better than they had been.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, behind me lies a sort of an artist obsession with wanting to present their work the best way they possibly can. If something's absolutely there and you've created it and you feel that you want it out there in the best form, then it should be you that makes the mistake in the presentation. Because if someone else makes the mistake, and I'd published about 5 books I'd written, photographed with wonderful publishers, Cobb Horwood in Auckland, but they'd sent it to the books to print in China, the colour hadn't been correct, some of the editing was dreadful, so I could blame them. So I think in some ways if you publish yourself, there's really one backstop and you're looking at it in the mirror, aren't you?
I need to say that where I got, I think, or where somebody got, and then I got, the fact that your mother had Jewish ancestry, which you say is not the case, is on your Wikipedia page. And you have no idea how to edit that, do you?
Well, I don't even really ever read Wikipedia.
Didn't even know you had a Wikipedia page.
No, that's the truth of it.
Astonishing, isn't it? Mm. The next track is Bob Dylan. I do recall that you have a Bob Dylan quote for every single opportunity.
Yeah, some people apologise for that. I don't.
Yes.
I don't. I think you're absolutely wonderful.
We could rely. Yeah. Striding through the desert of Mongolia, Craig would find some Bob Dylan quote that was entirely apposite.
Well, listen to this one. It's wonderful.
Once I had mountains in the palm of my hand.
And rivers that ran through every day.
I once held her in my arms. She said she would always stay. But I was cruel, I treated her like a fool. I threw it all away. Once I hit mountains in the palm of my hand, and rivers that ran through every day. That must have been mad. I never knew what I had until I threw it all away. Love is all there is. It makes the world go round. Love and only love, it can't be denied. No matter what you think about it, you just won't be able to do without it. Take a tip from one who's tried. So if you find someone who gives you all of her love, take it to your heart, don't let it stray. Oh, one thing for certain, you will surely be hurting if you throw it all away. If you throw it all away.
Bob Dylan, I throw it all away. I'm talking to Craig Potten. We were talking about when you first became involved in conservation.
Yes.
Was photography closely allied with that, or did it predate it or postdate it? What happened?
Photography actually predated it in the sense that I used to go out mountain climbing and surfing, which I think I've already mentioned before.
You may happen to mention surfing.
And I took images of my mate surfing, but not a lot because you're out there yourself. But in the mountains, I was a bit more serious about my photography. So I was taking photographs from the day my dad gave me a box brownie when I was 12 years old, and, you know, filing them very carefully.
Have you still got those?
My life story. Yeah, I have actually.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they were the first photographs I took were of animals, both animals in the wild. We went to a farm, and animals in a zoo in Auckland. These poor animals with these big bars sitting in front of them. And perhaps the thing I feel most sad about in the way we treat the world is the way we treat other forms of life, the way we treat animals. And there they were in the very first photographs I took, and a lion just looking as though it was in a state of hell, which it was, behind these bars in Auckland Zoo. And they were the first photos I took. So you could say it's, you know, just been a long train coming on the same theme. But the photographs were there, sorry, to get back to the point. And then when we started conservation, I was mainly writing arguments for why we should save things, enthusing people for saving things, giving public talks with slides, what we called cottage meetings, to get people to write submissions to decision makers. And it was obvious that my slides were working better than some other people's. In other words, I was taking images that were working. And so there was a sort of a political context around a lot of the photography I then did in places like the Paparoas with Andy Dennis, because we wanted to protect this beautiful forest. We wanted to not just spray out a number of arguments that, you know, talked about the science, but also just show how beautiful these places were. And they were places that obviously humans can't make, but humans can destroy. I mean, that was our idealistic theme of those times and remains so today.
So did you just make up the photographs as you went along, or did you do a course or what?
Yeah, no, I definitely made them up as I went along, but then I say at the same time that I'm not self-taught of anything, really, and as much as I think with Bob Dylan's words. I actually take images with Ansel Adams in the back of my head as well. So I would go into bookshops when I didn't have enough money. Now I do have enough to buy books, and just thumb through books of very good photographers and just look, what are they doing? And I remember writing to Peter Dombrowski, a wonderful photographer in Australia, saying, how did you get all the top of the photograph the same exposure as the bottom of the photograph? There's always more light at the top because that's where the sky is, you know, and the land down here. And he came back with split neutral density filter, Craig, you know, didn't know me at all. I spoke to Brian Brake, wonderful man. How do you do this, Brian? Oh, you just rack your ASA up to 3054. So I was actually always learning from other people, and Robert Adams in America. So I was precocious, pretentious enough perhaps to write to people who I thought were best in their field, and it didn't matter which part of the world they were in, and ask them questions. And many, to my absolute delight, replied to me. So whenever anyone asks me a question, I make a point of replying.
So you've got two books on the go at the moment.
Yes.
One of them is New Zealand Forest Interiors, what we were talking about, the double take.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one?
The other one has got a sort of a tentative title of Pilgrimages in the Tibetan Buddhist Himalayas. It's too much of a mouthful, and I need something that's a little bit more poetic or lyric around that. But what I'm with that working title, I've written five chapters. I've written them. I've got a very good editor, so we'll be working away on that and getting them into shape to take images that I've taken over the last 30 years on regular trips to the Himalayas. And
How many trips?
Well, I'm supposing I've been there around about 15 or 16. I haven't counted, but many times I've been to the Himalayas. And
what draws you back there?
What draws me back? Well, when I was a kid,
we've got mountains here, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I've climbed
perfectly good mountains here, Craig.
Thank you for stating the bleeding obvious, Kim.
Actually, we saw some very nice mountains in Mongolia, didn't we?
We did. We saw some beautiful mountains.
Although you first made us go to the desert because you wanted naked sand dunes to photograph.
Precisely, yes.
Of which we have an example on our webpage, which makes it perfectly evident why you wanted naked sand dunes, because it's fantastic, the shadows.
I think so. And also I think that with deserts, that it's the one landscape we don't have in New Zealand. So yes, we do have mountains. I take your point, and I've climbed many of them and spent a lot of time in them. But we don't have these wonderful deserts that you get in the middle of the central parts of big continents. So, you know, I wanted to drag all of you, because Tim Cope and I pretty much put the itinerary together, to the edge of the...
Listeners might remember Tim Cope. He was the author of a book called On the Trail of Genghis Khan.
Mm.
And completely unbeknownst to me, you and another mutual friend organised this trip to Mongolia, and he was running it. Yeah. He's a great guy, isn't he?
Oh, he's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
So
you're going to be working with him on a book?
I'm hoping to. You know, we have lots of plans in life, and some of them happen and some don't. But we did talk together when we were over there and got on very well, and we've spoken a bit since about doing a book with images, not trying to be in any way definitive in my photography, but quality images, art images, if you wish, of landscape and people of Mongolia, particularly Western Mongolia.
Because you don't do people very often, do you?
Well, I actually do people.
And do
one
you?
Of, yep, and one of the images of a camel herder, a woman, you know, tapping a camel into the right direction in the evening. But I do a lot of portrait work, particularly in the batch during summer, of my son growing up from young through adolescence into manhood, of my daughter growing through, of my partner, of her friends, of BJ, the local guys, and the visitors to the place. I do a lot of portraiture work. I have exhibited it overseas, but not much in New Zealand.
Ah, well, that's why I think you don't do it.
Mm, that's right. The public persona isn't necessarily what the inner man's doing all the time.
I like that camel herder. I remember those. There were thousands of camels, right? And they were baby camels.
Yes.
And they were herding the baby camels so that they could milk the mother camels.
And here they go. They were singing too.
They hummed.
Oh, I loved that hum. I loved it. And then the sand dunes sung. Remember that? I know you weren't with us.
No.
You went on a horse the other way, but we walked over sand dunes. And the dunes started singing as well. And I'd heard these images, and I read Annie Dillard and people that say that stones might talk, and yes, 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 but they actually did make a noise.
What noise was it?
It was like... So it was almost like throat singing, you know, when they're warming up to throat singing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was coming, we were going down a big dune, and lo and behold, the dune started talking to us while we were going down.
Really?
And I didn't expect it. I just found it. I mean, I do have these moments of extreme excitement, and that was one of them.
Wow. No, yeah. I missed that.
It's brilliant.
I have a moment of extreme excitement remembering you when your knees got a bit sore because they've taken a bit of punishment over time, I think, your knees, and you deigned to get on a horse. And the Mongolian horses are so small that your feet would have brushed the ground had you not scrunched them up into the stirrups.
Yeah.
You didn't find that very comfortable, I don't think.
No, I didn't. When a horse goes up, then my bum's coming down and there's not much of my bum anyway. Mm. And then when I'm not in sync with horses, Kim, and I noticed that you are and Kay, who travelled with us, was, and I am not, so...
It's good to know these things, though, isn't it?
It is. It's good to know your weaknesses, yeah.
Anyway, back to the point, Craig. Mm. The Himalayas.
The Himalayas. So there's this beautiful, high, extraordinary mountain range that is sort of the subject of dreams when you're young and reading of the early French climb on Annapurna and the Germans on Nanga Parbat and all that sort of, you know, boys' own stuff when you're 12 years old. So I had read that. I had that love of the mountains from climbing New Zealand mountains. And then, you know, to top it off, you find out about a thing called Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism is still practiced in the high mountains in these beautiful gompas. And they are beautiful and they're extraordinarily painted inside of the deities, which are just really the representations of your mind in some sort of physical form out there. You study Buddhism at university for 7 years. Some people said that's too long, but then nevertheless, you study it and then you go to this place where it's being practiced and you just keep going back.
What do you mean? You studied Buddhism at university for 7 years?
Effectively, yes. I did a religious studies degree and an English degree, and then I combined the two for my MA, and I took a year where I did a few other things as well to get those two BAs together to do the MA.
Ah.
So, yep, there's a reason to go for me to go there. And the cliche is very true, which is that those people have found a sense of the relationship of the self or the individual to the environment, to the families that they live in, to the community they're in, that does make them happy. And I sit on a word called happy quite strongly because often I find people over there, God, this is subjective, but it's true, are happier than some of us. Mm. You know, we walk around with a bit of a dour sort of moany, sarcastic, cynical aspect on life.
Well, speak for yourself.
Well, I'm speaking for myself, but I'm also speaking for...
Me, I'm a little ray of sunshine.
Well,
you know.
Not all the time, Kim. You've been known to pass a bit of sarcasm over the table.
Not me.
Yes.
Oh.
But yeah.
You're still vegetarian, I take it. Nobody ever stops being vegetarian, do they?
No, they don't.
Is that because you're a Buddhist inclined?
It was because I read Gandhi when I was 15 years old, and I come from a meat-eating family, for sure, for sure. That's one thing my father and I completely disagreed on. And Gandhi said you don't have to eat meat and that animals are sentient beings and that they have emotions and that they some of them mate for life, etc., etc. Well, he didn't say all of that, but I'm saying it in retrospect. And he put me onto the fact that I didn't have to eat it. Therefore, you know, my moral obligation to be kinder to sentient beings was a lot easier.
Yeah. Haven't the Buddhists got a strange take on meat eating? Like, if somebody else kills it, it's all right?
Yes, definitely. The last chapter of my book is on Shabkar, who was a Buddhist lama who broke that chain of what they call karmic association. So he's the great hope at the end of the book because, yes, Tibetan Buddhists in particular, not so much Indian Buddhism, which isn't practiced as much now, but Tibetan Buddhists have felt that because if you don't do the killing, then somehow or other the karma resides on the killer side, the executioner, if you wish, and you're karma-free for eating it. Karma being the sort of moral feeling that you have or that you accrue from doing something wrong or right. And so bad karma is, you know, hurting someone. Good karma is being nice to them. So you don't have that effect of bad karma. But that has always been a tension within Buddhism. So Milarepa and Padmasambhava and the very early Buddhist lamas, the great teachers, yes, they did eat meat, but they also felt uncomfortable about it. And I think a lot of people are like that.
It's a bit of a moral cop-out, isn't it?
Well, it is. If you ask the average person, you know, you go out there and kill the animal you're going to eat, most people won't actually do it by choice. Mm. They'd rather it was done somewhere else and presented at the supermarket. Shagpa put them, and that's the last chapter of the book. You've got to buy the book, go right to the end, and find out that Tibetan Buddhism is changing, like we're all changing, and within the next 50 years, no one will be eating meat.
That's what you think?
I do think we're going that way. I mean, it's not just to do with global warming, but if you read a recent listener article, it made it very clear that, one very strong way to stop the earth heating up is to stop eating meat. Also, I believe in this time where we're very destructive on nature, we're also finding out a huge amount about animals' cognitive abilities, but it's not just that they're smart or not smart, but also their emotional and social connections that they have. And surprise, surprise, we're finding that they are very similar to a lot of other mammals, including humans. And that being the case, it makes you feel more concerned about taking their lives. So if you're taking the life of someone, a fish which mates for life or a bird which mates for life, you're making the survivor unhappy as well.
Were you a bit worried about going to Mongolia?
Yes.
Because me too, I thought I was going to have to take instant noodles.
Well, no, I've been to enough trips to the East to know that these people are not without their knowledge of the West and not without their knowledge of...
Well, fortunately, we had two very good cooks on the trek.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, had we been enjoying the hospitality of the Gur people, which, of course, we did, the nomads, because they're tremendously hospitable, it was either dairy products or meat.
Would have been considerably
nothing
harder.
Nothing else.
I think, you'd look for potatoes, you'd look for beans, you'd look for other things. But
they don't have potatoes and beans.
You would have struggled.
They have one berry that seems to provide them with vitamin C called sea buckthorn.
Yep.
And you know, it tasted like feet.
It did. But, Kim, I did notice that many of them, as is contemporary world, did have vehicles and did go to towns.
Yes.
And did bring back products. So
no, they're
I
quite
think
right.
we could have done that.
What did you think about the nomad way of life?
It was one of the reasons I was very attracted to the Himalayas as well, was not only is it there in Mongolia, in which we found it an extremely beautiful form and practiced very much as it has been for a long time. Apart from the odd motor vehicle and the, television area outside some of the Gurs, they were still following the life of the animal. Into
as Tim put it, they live... When we domesticate animals, we force the animals to live like
that's right.
we do.
Yeah.
But the Mongolian nomads live like the animals do.
They move with their animals seasonally to give them the best, feed. And that, I think, and that's also in Tibet and other places that I've been in the Himalayas. And so it gets them into a rhythmic understanding of the world and the earth and what it provides in a way that we don't have. It keeps them in a close units of families, which is very strong. And I'm sure they have squabbles like every family does, but... it also leads to a contentment that's related to their animal, to the beautiful land. They know it's beautiful. They tell you it's beautiful as soon as you arrive there, which is quite neat, I think. That's quite wonderful. So they're acknowledging that. And then you say, well, what do you want of your children? We just want them to continue this lifestyle, but they'll have to go to school in the local village, etc. So they're positive about where they are, and their sense of place is very strong. And they are following bigger rhythms than their own egos. And for all of those reasons, both Tim Cope and myself feel very positive about seeing what's happened, with nomads and the way they live as a counter image to the way that we're, delivering life to young kids these days, which is, break your family up, head off to another place, do university, then get into a small nuclear group and find yourself with a lot of anxiety.
One of the points that Tim made, and I hadn't spelled it out to myself, but he said a lot of people assume that the nomads were poor.
No.
And I suppose that was my thinking in some subconscious level. But they're incredibly wealthy. They just, you wouldn't buy stuff with it because you've got to move it.
That's right.
Because you're nomadic. Mm. So what they do is they buy more animals.
They buy more animals, and I find throughout the Himalayas, for better or worse, they decorate. In effect, they decorate their women and their men. They have big caches of jewellery quite often, be it turquoise.
Do you think the nomad in Mongolia did?
I think some of those people had the boxes they weren't show you would have had turquoise and gold and various, what has been currency in the past. Jewellery is precious stones, precious metals, heirlooms. that they carried with them, that they passed on to their daughters, that passed on to their sons, that, you know, so the dowry sort of, all those sorts of things were, and it's a very Eastern thing. It was the case in the West, but we've lost it. So they carry their wealth quite often, both on the body or as adornments to the body. And that's not a bad thing. It's probably quite a nice way to carry your wealth.
They're Buddhist as well.
Some of them are, and some of them were shamanistic.
Yeah. And then you've got the Kazakhs who are a Muslim.
Islam. But a certain form of Islam, and I think it needs pointing out that they are very influenced by Sufism, which is a more mystical form of Islam than you receive in other parts of the world. But yes, you're right. And yet they seemed not too at odds with each other. They were moving through the landscape, all three.
Yeah.
Whether they were shamanistic or Buddhist or...
They were all nomads. That's the big thing they had in common,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, true, true. And they all looked to the sky and they all looked to the earth. So they had what you'd call perhaps animistic beliefs in there as well. You remember them throwing the milk to the sky in the morning and blessing it and just saying thank you for the sun coming up. And so they weren't tied to a sort of dogmatic theology. I didn't feel that. I mean, obviously, I didn't spend enough time with them to be able to pontificate as I am, but that's what I felt.
Yeah. Would you go back?
Oh, I'd absolutely go back. Yep.
Well, you'd have to, maybe, if you and Tim are writing a book.
Yes, totally. Hey? Yep. Yep. I mean, we saw the desert. We saw the nomads. We saw the camels. God, I love those camels.
I love those camels.
Yeah, just brilliant. You know.
Yeah, especially the ones that look like Donald Trump.
Huh? Well, I didn't think that, luckily.
Oh, you
did. I tried to block that man right out of my life. I just thought they were hilarious. They chewed. They had, the most open jaw on the planet. They were, just lovely vegetarians that I couldn't understand a word they were saying.
Well, you let me know when you go back, because I'll come along too. You'll love that.
You'll have to find a horse.
Craig, I'll have to find you. Craig Potten.